The first case for oral argument this morning is the Secretary of State Chris Nelson, appellant, versus Promise and Future, and Roger Hunt, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Jeffrey Hallam, Assistant Attorney General from Pierce, South Dakota. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Stephen Sanford, an attorney from Sioux Falls. The court would like to welcome students from Esteline High School and the Ravillo Dual High Schools, and also South Dakota State University, who we understand are attending these proceedings. Mr. Hallam, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. Before I begin, I'd like to recognize Secretary of State Chris Nelson that's in the audience as well. This is an appeal from a judgment of dismissal. The circuit court ruled that the actions of defendants and the unnamed third party did not create a ballot question committee. Secretary of State respectfully disagrees, and as such, we're here today. The issues before the court are solely questions of law, and as such, the court's standard of review is de novo. The issue before the court is whether the actions of defendants, Roger Hunt and Promising Future, Inc., together with the unnamed third party, created a ballot question committee. If a ballot question committee was created, that ballot question committee had certain reporting requirements. Those requirements included the disclosure of the source of the contributions.
Is that the only impact of this decision, since the legislature's changed the law? But this really has no forward-looking precedent, but it would be merely to disclose the name?
Actually, Your Honor, it does have some precedent on it because there's a similar case currently at the trial court level that's being stayed, and that's dealing with State versus Mullen and Carrico.
Under the
similar
old law.
Facts, same law. That is a criminal action because there was no filing of a statement. So there is the issues before the court. If the court determined that a ballot question committee was not created, it would have a very direct impact on the ability for the state to go forward in that criminal action. So it's more than just this case currently before the court. This case arose out of the referral of House Bill 1215 at the 2006 general election. What we had was shortly before the election on September 14th, we had the incorporation of Promising Future, Inc., and the activities occurred afterwards are reported through VoteYesForLife.com's ballot question committee report dealing with recognition of contributions and the support of the adoption of Referred Law 6. They showed three $250,000 contributions. What you have in this case is the allegations of the Secretary of State have been admitted by defendants. And those allegations say that this corporation, Promising Future, Inc., was created by the unnamed third party and defendant Hunt for the sole purpose of the providing of personal assets going through the corporation to be dispersed in support of a ballot question measure. That, in effect, what we have is a corporate shell that was created to hide the identity of the contributor. The question is that when one looks at it objectively, it's obvious the defendants attempted to circumvent the state's campaign financing reporting laws. The question is whether they were successful. What the Secretary of State has asserted both down below and on appeal is they were not successful. These actions of attempting to circumvent the campaign finance statutes, in effect, created a ballot question committee.
What are you asking for here? Are you asking for a reversal in a trial, or are you saying that you should win as a matter of law?
Both.
Both?
The questions are solely questions of law on it, and the court would be, if the court declared that a ballot question committee was created, then as to the statutory construction issue, the case is over with on it because you have the reporting requirements and you have the identification requirement. What would be left is a First Amendment argument dealing with traditional First Amendment analysis, and that would be whether the state's campaign financing reporting statutes are constitutional. Now, there has been a constitutionality issue raised by Mr. Sanford, and the court could decide whether to hear that or not. That also is solely a question of law, but that only deals with a very limited part of the First Amendment. That's a matter of whether there was an absolute prohibition based upon subjective intent. And we feel that that First Amendment argument is baseless. But if the court chose to decide that and remanded it back, then we would just have the traditional First Amendment issue before the court. So in effect, you would have as a reversal, you'd have a decision on the statutory grounds and a remanding back to determine whether the statute is constitutional both on its face and as applied to this case.
Did anyone ask the trial court judge to rule on that question also, so that in the event you win this time, you don't have to go back to the trial court?
We had some factual findings because the posture of this case, defendants decided to go on a judgment on the pleadings, and they also decided to admit all the allegations of the complaint for a summary judgment, is that on the First Amendment argument, there were some issues left. The court could decide the First Amendment issue without these, but the question is whether the state had a substantial interest in the ballot campaign financing statutes, and whether applying the various standards, whether the regulations were reasonable. We had some evidence to support. We have an expert witness who would provide that. Some courts have decided as a matter of law that it's constitutional on its face, and you don't need to have any evidence. We weren't sure what the circuit court would do, so that was stayed. The court, because they're all questions of law, could decide everything and the case would be over with. There would be no reason to remand it. But that would, in effect, deciding some issues that weren't before the court, also deciding some issues that weren't fully briefed before the court.
You're still going to have to try the question of whether or not the sole purpose of PFI was to create a corporate shell by which shareholders could secretly get this money. I mean, that's only been, as I read the record, that's only been admitted for purposes of this motion. You would still have to prove that, would you not?
Mr. Sanford can answer that question, Your Justice. Arguably, that would be true on it, but Mr. Sanford would be able to describe that more than I could.
Well, you do talk about, if I'm understanding that question, you do talk about in your reply brief the piercing the corporate veil. Was that addressed, or would that have to be findings of fact that would need to be discussed?
If the court remanded it back to make the factual determinations as Justice Inner went in, then we would have to develop a factual record, and that is whether the facts are similar to what we've alleged in the complaint, that being that the corporation was non-existent, hasn't taken any actions other than acting as a facilitator of personal action, that being allowing the person to make the contributions through the corporation contributing it out. Those would all be facts that would be relevant to be decided. And that factual development wasn't allowed to go forward because defendant was exercising their procedural rights that allowed it to go forward on a judgment on the pleadings.
The election's over. Mr. Hunt's position did not prevail. The law did not pass, which he supported. The law has now been changed. Why are we here?
Again, the two reasons. One is it's the public's right to know the statutes were violated, in our opinion, and there's liability to be imposed. This was an enforcement action by the Secretary of State on it. The action was filed before the repeal of the statutes on it. We had an existing viable live case. Also, the precedent of the court would be viable for the current criminal action that's down in the circuit court, which we included in the reply brief. There is a public policy reason to continue. There are criminal sanctions to be involved. So the application of the statutes, whether this action created a ballot question committee, is relevant, it is alive, it is viable, and the public has the right to know who was the contributor on it for the purpose of a violation of a statute. In our opinion, the application of the statute clearly applies in this case. What you have in a ballot question committee are basically simple elements. They are two or more people cooperating. In this case, you clearly have three people cooperating, that being Hunt, the unnamed third party, in creating the corporation, and then the cooperation that continued between the unnamed third party, Hunt, and the corporation that allowed the collecting of personal assets and dispersing it to a ballot question committee to support the adoption of referred Measure 6.
As far as cooperating, say that you're going to church that passed the offering plate and you put $5 in the plate. Does that mean you're cooperating, or have you merely put something in the offering plate?
In this case, you have more than just putting money in the offering plate. What you have is a creation of a corporation for the specific purpose of collecting revenues on it. That this is not merely an offering plate. The corporation is not merely an agent of Hunt. What this was is a cooperative effort to collect money and disperse money on it. It had to have cooperation. This is something the unnamed third party couldn't do on their own. And it's something that Hunt could not do on his own. Also, the ballot question committee, on its very nature, that's what it operates as. It is an entity that collects funds, just like an offering plate. So you have that. The ballot question committee goes out there and passes the plate and says, we would like to have money to support the adoption or a repeal of a measure. So you have that cooperating activity on it because somebody is initiating the conduct to put the activity together on it. So you have those people that created it. You have ushers and people that are cooperating for that conduct to happen. So it is somewhat analogous, Your Honor. This is not independent conduct. This is not conduct under an established single entity. These are a group of people that got together to make a decision to collect money and disperse money.
So then the fact that they put the corporation, I guess, I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but if you just look at it from the corporation, that's only one person. So you have to go back. Your argument is that in order to get the two or more people who cooperate, you go back prior to the time they created the corporation. Is that your argument?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, because what you have is September 14th, this entity was created. And for the purpose right now before the court is the sole purpose of that creation was to act as a funding conduit, to create a funding conduit. It had no other purpose. So what it is just a shell. And so under those circumstances, a corporation just hasn't been created that's a legitimate corporation. It is a shell for personal activity.
Do you have to pierce the corporate veil in order to get there? Or do you just look at it at its inception, as opposed to after it's created and then you pierce it, I guess?
I think, Your Honor, is why I use piercing the corporate veil as an analogy, because what you have is activity before the creation of it. So what you have is activity that was ballot question creating. If you remove the corporation on it, you still have Hunt and the unnamed third party who are cooperating to collect money and disperse it. You know, this is not a case where Hunt was just acting as a mailman. You know, what it was changing the identity of the money. So what you have is you have money moving from a person to another identity and dispersing it out. So you have that cooperative activity. You have two or more people doing it. What we're saying is the corporation is involved. And really what the corporation looks like is the same thing as you would do as if you created a ballot question committee. It's an entity that was used to collect and disperse money to support a ballot question measure.
Well, the trial court relied upon contribution as opposed to disbursement.
Yep. And a contribution by statutory definition is what's received by a committee, so it doesn't advance the argument at all. So in this case, it is the unnamed third party made a contribution to the ballot question committee, and then that ballot question committee made a contribution to another one because that's what's received. So Vote Yes for Life still had to report that contribution because in their books, it was money that was received in support of a ballot measure. Now, for the committee that had it, that is an expense because it's a campaign expenditure that they had to report. And then also the money that they received was a contribution coming in from the unnamed third party that had to be reported. So whether it's a contribution, that doesn't advance the argument any. What you have to do is look at the statutory elements on it, and you have collecting, raising, or dispersing. Those are words of plain, ordinary meaning. They're not very confusing. They're straightforward words. And you have collecting of money and dispersing of money. Now, from the ballot question context, that's also contributions and campaign expenditures, but that doesn't change the fact that the statutory definition has been met. I mean, the legislature purposely did not use those magic words, contribution and campaign expenditure, I think for obvious reasons, so that people didn't get confused. They used very simple, straightforward words, so if anybody looking at it wouldn't be confused and there wouldn't be any doubt on what's going on, that the statutes aren't vague on their face or as applied.
You know, the statute's been changed, so this kind of a setup can't be done now. But if we follow the proposition that what the legislature has not specifically declared to be illegal is therefore legal, what rule specifically prohibited the creation of a shell corporation in order to accomplish what these people did?
Nothing prohibited the creation of a shell corporation. It just didn't create a single entity. What we're saying is the cooperative action was there on it. And that's where putting form over substance, and that's where if the court's looking only at, the post-creation on it, then that's where setting aside or piercing the corporate veil analogies come into effect. I mean, this is basically personal conduct. You know, the unnamed third party contributing money for a ballot question, that's personal conduct, that's personal choice. There's no business corporation aspect involved with it. What you have is a corporate shell in the middle acting as a conduit. This court's never recognized the validity of those type of things creating unity of conduct, and nor has any court done that, where it's just being created for this purpose. This isn't like an established corporation. I mean, the court could take judicial notice as part of the record that, you know, there were contributions by various corporations and other ballot measures. Verizon contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars. But that's an established corporation that used its own treasury stock for business operations to support a ballot measure. If we had that here today, we wouldn't be here, Your Honor. This is a matter of this was created just for this purpose. It had no existence separate apart.
This third party could have used Verizon or General Electric or Kellogg's and made contributions to them, and that third party would not be disclosed?
No, Your Honor. If they cooperated together to collect money, then you could create a ballot question committee. But if a corporation is using its own corporate assets, a corporation, like a marriage, you have marital assets. You know, you have certain assets that can be utilized. Now, if those assets were being utilized, that doesn't mean that it's multiplicity of conduct on it. But to take personal assets, put it into a corporation, and then to get it out, to say that now all of a sudden that's unity of conduct on it, that's a distinction with a difference. Also, if you had a corporation that was soliciting contributions from people, that activity would be a ballot question committee.
How does a committee normally work?
How a committee normally works is that two or more people get together and they say, we're going to create a ballot question committee. We're going to go out and collect and raise and disperse money.
Do they have a bank account normally, or how do they do that?
They do that because they don't have to, Your Honor, but they do, at least from under the old law, they didn't. But, you know, there had to be a separate segregation of assets. You had to show what was going on, and you had certain reporting requirements. Under the new law, there's more restrictive things, but in effect, you and I could be.
Then they would do a list of whoever they collected the money from, and then that would be filed. Is that how it works?
Over $100, you'd put a list, and then you'd have to put your expenditures and list what you expended so the public could see what went on. And this is what it is. It's to allow transparency for the election process so people don't have to wonder who contributed it and why they contributed it, and having a bunch of entities that nobody understands, they get to see who's behind the actual campaign financing.
What if a person read about Mr. Hunt's efforts before the election in the paper and happened to agree with him, so they wrote out a check for $500 and simply mailed it to him? And that's their only conduct. Same result?
Any ballot question committee can receive contributions from people because it's acting in cooperation to fund it. So if you had a group of people and they received the money, even though it came from mail, there's still a ballot question committee. If they were acting solely as a postman, didn't change it, there may be a circumstance, Your Honor. If you gave... If I was solely as a mailman and having no capacity, control, or ownership, didn't do anything, I think then you didn't create a ballot question committee. But if I was cooperating for the purpose And that's what it is one of these things is for the purpose of making these. If somebody mailed in money to me, that I treat that as a contribution. So the question is did I cooperate for the purpose? And that's key word purpose. That's why the subjective intent arguments that defendants are making make no sense. You have to have purpose. And that's a statutory element. Also, subjective intent doesn't apply here in this case under the First Amendment grounds if the court chooses to do it, because subjective intent only goes to the speech itself. That's whether it's issue advocacy versus express advocacy. Creation of an entity doesn't deal with speech. So we view this whole subjective intent First Amendment argument as a big red herring that has nothing to apply. The courts have always said that you can regulate entities that are involved in elections, whether that be ballot or campaign.
Your time is
candidates. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Sanford, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Just a time. Watches. Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, may it please the court, counsel. My name is Steve Sanford. For the record, I represent Roger Hunt and Promising Futures, Inc. In this appeal. I'm here for one primary purpose, and that is to ask this court to affirm the very, very, very simple and undeniable logic used by the trial court in granting the defendant's summary judgment in this matter. I feel like if I talk for full 20 minutes, I'll overcomplicate what is a very, very simple question that I think could be understood by saying it this way. According to the Secretary of State, a jackrabbit can be a coyote if the secretary decides that the animal is too wily to be a jackrabbit. And, of course, here, that's sort of offensive to jackrabbits, but that really is the statutory argument that the state makes, is that a contributor can become a ballot question committee if it forms, if a certain intent in his, her, or its head, to the extent an it can have a head. And the problem with that, of course, is that there is no statute, or there was not, in 2006, allowing the Secretary of State to make that distinction. In other words, to say that a contributor becomes a ballot question committee if the contributor has a motive I don't like.
Is that, I don't see that that's the issue here. Obviously, we can't look at that. But isn't really the question, can you do by incorporating what you couldn't do by not incorporating?
That is certainly one of the questions, and I think is the second question in the analysis. And going back to Justice Konenkamp's question, this process ought to be a search for a law that says a person cannot use a corporation to make a contribution, or a person must, as a contributor, make a contribution to a ballot question committee only in his, her, or its name. Before 2007, our statutes were simply devoid of any such requirements. Chapter 1225, which does not exist anymore, made clear distinctions between a ballot question committee and a contributor, and impose certain burdens and restrictions on contributors as opposed to ballot question committees. For instance, monetary limits were put on contributors, $1,000 for contributions to candidates for national office, $250 otherwise. Those requirements weren't imposed, those limitations were not imposed on any sort of committee, just on contributors. In addition, corporations were forbidden from making contributions to any election or public contest other than to ballot question committees. So clearly, the legislature had in mind some restrictions on contributors, distinguishing contributors from ballot question committees. But the restrictions, the burdens, the limitations, and the rules for contributors stopped there. And ballot question committees have reporting requirements, but no matter what, there is no statute imposing a disclosure requirement or a reporting requirement on any contributor, no matter what the contributor's motive. So the idea that a ballot question committee can be created by a contributor when the contributor has a motive the secretary does not like,
isn't there an argument, though, not the contribution, but the where you go back before the formation of the corporation? That's my understanding, is the argument of the state, is that you go back to say what was the purpose when these people got together and then formed the corporation, as opposed to after the fact and the contribution. Is there... And I don't know that the circuit court addressed that difference.
If that turns a contributor into a ballot question committee, then you have an absurdly unworkable statutory scheme. For instance, consider two people in the audience who find out that they think alike on a particular question and want to make a contribution to it, but one of them doesn't have a check. But it has cash, and so hands the other person, here's my half, you write a check. Under the secretary's argument, and I think flawed statutory interpretation, that turns two very innocent people into criminals. Because under the secretary's argument, statutory argument, that cooperation of the one giving the cash to the other and the other writing a check for an amount that is not his money, it belongs half to somebody else who is not disclosed, then those two people become a ballot question committee and have reporting requirements, the failure of which is a criminal act.
You're assuming that they are... They are doing it for the adoption or defeat of any questions submitted to the voters at any election? The two people in the audience.
Sure. But they're also...
Okay, then why are they not two or more people who cooperate and raise and collect and disperse money because they're doing it for the adoption or defeat of any questions submitted to the voters at any election? Why aren't they a ballot collection committee?
For two reasons, the second being the most impressive. The first reason is it then makes the distinction between contributors and ballot question committees absurdly overbroad and unregulatable.
Right. They disperse money. The fact that you later label money contributions, it still meets the statute. You're still dispersing money, whether it's in check or cash or whatever.
So when my wife and I disperse under the court's use of disbursement money to a ballot question committee because there are two of us, and it comes out of my wife's separate checking account showing only her name. She and I are a ballot question committee. I don't believe that the legislature intended that kind of result. An informal gathering of like-minded people that result in all of them making contributions, that's not a ballot question committee. Every corporation, virtually every corporation, is comprised of more than one person, employees, officers, whatever. If they discuss something among themselves and send in a check, a corporate check, they're a ballot question committee under that broad an interpretation. And I think you can have confidence that the secretary does not believe that either. Because 300 corporations in 2006 made contributions to ballot question committees, and the secretary has not taken the position that their cooperation, the undeniable cooperation that it took to make that donation to a ballot question committee, made the contribution a disbursement.
Is that your second reason?
Pardon?
Was that your second reason? You had
yes.
said you had two. Okay.
Yes, it was. And so you can take your clue, I believe, from the secretary that the secretary has never, until this instance, made that claim and still doesn't make that claim as to these other 300 corporations whose undeniable internal cooperation
was
required.
Just as an aside, does an officer's subsequent actions, say on enforcements or something, if somebody is speeding, going down the road and they're speeding, and the officer says, oh, I'm tired, I'm going to let this one go by, does that mean that's not speeding? Does it require the enforcement of the rule to meet the definition of speeding?
First of all, the officer is not an elected statewide agency. The Secretary of State's office makes rules, applies the rules, and this court has long held that an agency interpretation in its conduct is relevant to this court. Obviously, the selective enforcement, except on discriminatory grounds, would not necessarily be a defense. But here, it's overwhelming that the Secretary of State has not asserted this position for the other 300 or so corporations. And I think that's certainly relevant to this court in determining what the statute means, although this court obviously controls the interpretation of the statute in absence of other legislative action, which brings us to another critical point, and that is all this has been changed. All the things we've been talking about are now quote-unquote fixed. There, in fact, is now a law that says when you make a contribution to a ballot issue or an election, you have to use your own name. There is also now a statute that wasn't before, which requires certain information regarding corporate contributors. And under certain circumstances, if corporate contributors now have under 20 shareholders, they have to provide the name and address of the shareholders. None of this existed before. The legislature scrapped its old way of doing things and created a new way of doing things. And we believe that under 1820 cases from this court, in prior cases, it matters a lot in the interpretation of this existing statute whether there's been amendment to change what we're talking about. And that's what has happened. The legislature has, in fact, made a change.
Let's go back to the old law, though, because that's what we're dealing with today. And Isn't your analogy with the two people in the audience, or you and your wife, making a contribution, isn't that analogy different here because we've got an extra step where a corporation has been formed for the express purpose of making a donation? Doesn't that change the analogy when you take that additional step of people getting together to form a corporation to make that contribution?
There's no doubt that a corporation was formed, and in our assumed set of facts, we don't admit that was the sole purpose. In fact, the Articles of Incorporation quoted in the complaint state entirely different in other purposes, but we're assuming that's true for the sake of argument. It is the creation of a different entity, but the Secretary alleges there's nothing wrong with that except for the motive to protect the identity of the supposed shareholder. My wife and I disagree tremendously on various public issues and political and ballot question issues, and I might give her money and say, I don't want my name associated with it, but you can do it. And so she, in effect, takes money I've earned and makes the payment in her name. It's the same motive. I don't want my name associated with it, but I give her money. I don't think that there is a functional distinction between the two. And the examples point out that if this court buys the interpretation, all these other things, these other absurdities, are just as possible. And the reason they're possible is the subjective intent idea. It's not contained anywhere in any statute. The dialogue that we've had is not really about the express words of any statute. We're talking about an invention, not by the legislature, but by the Secretary of State. And so it was perfectly lawful in 2006 to make a donation in somebody else's name.
I disagree with you there in part, because the statute says any two or more people who cooperate for the purpose of raising, collecting, or dispersing money for the adoption or defeat of any question submitted to the voters at any election. The only motivation that's involved in any way is whether or not it complies with the statute, whether it was for the adoption or defeat of any question submitted to the voters at any election. So that's the motivation. That's the only intent we're dealing with here.
To comply
with the ballot question committee as stated, as defined by the statute.
Then virtually every single contributor to anything is a ballot question committee, because seldom are contributions made without discussion, without solicitation, without cooperative discussion. Someone asks me for money to contribute to a ballot question committee, and I say, okay, I will do that, or why should I do that, and we have a discussion, and I send in a check.
What
have the two of us done?
Maybe that's why the legislature rewrote the law, because as defined, as set forth, maybe it's too broad, and they don't want to include it that broad.
It also I think the interpretation eliminates the distinction that legislature intended between ballot question committees and contributors, because there's no principled, language-based, sensible, workable way to distinguish between contributors and ballot question committees. And if it is based on the subjective intent of a donor to protect his, her, or its own identity, the United States Supreme Court has clearly said that subjective intent-based regulations of protected political speech are unconstitutional, and they're violative of the First Amendment. And the Wisconsin Right to Life case decided last summer makes that point perfectly clear, that if you use subjective intent or perceptions of subjective intent to distinguish between protected political speech and contributions are collected, protected political speech, and between that and criminalized speech, that violates the First Amendment. Because there were four opinions in the case, you have to read them all carefully, but each one, each justice, each opinion rejects the idea that this so-called subjective intent standard, which, by the way, is not in the legislation we're dealing with, but even if it were, it is simply violative of the First Amendment to make a distinction on that basis as opposed to using objective factors.
Mr. Sanford, I want you to comment on one thing before your time's up. On the circuit court's reasoning, the circuit court said that there was, or that PFI did not raise collect money. Do you agree with that? That PFI did not raise or collect money for this purpose?
It didn't raise or collect money in any sense different than any of the examples I described, that if the statutory interpretation argument of the state is upheld would criminalize 90% of contributions. Because contributions is separately defined and is not included in the definition of ballot question committee, there has to be some sensible distinction between the two that does not result in criminalizing ordinary contribution behavior, which most often is a cooperative effort. So, no, a contribution, sending money to a ballot question committee who then spends it, no, that is not collecting or dispersing. And if it is, then no, that's what every contributor does.
Your time has expired, Mr. Sanford. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Hallam, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, what defendants and the unnamed third party did here was not corporate activity. We're not dealing with an established corporation with a business purpose that's acting through its officers on it. What you have is you have people cooperating to create a corporate shell. If Promising Future, Inc. was an established corporation and it had assets and it decided to expend those assets for a ballot question committee, and we wouldn't be here today because you only have one person. What you have here, though, is you have a corporation that was created. And that's why the activity before the creation of the corporation is relevant. And that cooperation was for the purpose of collecting money. Mr. Sanford can't get around that. The plain, ordinary definition of collecting, that's what the corporation did. And it was solely for the purpose of dispersing money to support the adoption of a ballot question measure. So you do not have a separate corporation where you can talk about unity of purpose. It's a sham. It's a shell. Marital assets. Both the husband and wife have the ability to use marital assets. You don't need to ask permission on it. You have independent conduct if a wife or a husband decides to expend those. You don't have cooperative activity. My wife doesn't ask my permission to give money to support a candidate. She has the right and ability to do it, whether it came from my paycheck or hers.
What if you decide together to make a contribution? I know you don't. I know you can both be independent. But what if you do collaborate on an issue and decide?
Well, then I'm giving them under. She's going to contribute the maximum, and so am I, so I can contribute as much as I can. I mean, It's a single asset, single person. It's a marriage is a single entity for legal purposes on it. So to use those type things as an analogy, Your Honor, doesn't fit this where Mr. Hunt had no right, title, or ownership to the unnamed third party's money. He took it. And so what you have is a change of the nature of the asset on it. You have money that went from the unnamed third party to the corporation, changed its identity on it. So where you have a situation where the cooperative activity changes the nature of the asset, then you do. And the example is if I collected money from Mr. Sanford and put it solely under my name, I have no right, title, or ownership to that money. I violated the statute technically on it. So that would be a violation. We cooperated. I took ownership of that money. I collected it and I dispersed it. Our cooperative activity would create it. But that's about the only circumstance that would be there. The other circumstances of a corporation or a marriage just don't fit the statutes on it. And not every hypothetical that one can think of makes a statute vague or overbroad. What you have here is straightforward language of cooperating activity on it. And the subjective intent, we said for what is the purpose of the activity, and that was to make a contribution. The only reason the subjective intent is at all relevant is motivation. Why would you go through all this activity? Why would you create a corporation? Why would you do it? In any criminal case on it, you have motive to explain to people is why the heck did they do it? Why does this make sense? Why does this seemingly... Why? That doesn't change the element on it. That doesn't change the requirements. But it does explain a key thing to a normal person is why. That's all the subjective intent is done here is why would they do something like this? It doesn't change the fact that the state can legitimately regulate ballot question committees because they are performing express advocacy. There's no issue advocacy here. The sole speech is issue advocacy. In fact, the Supreme Court, when they look at the ability to regulate an entity, they go, what is the purpose of the entity? So what Mr. Sanford is trying to confuse the court is purpose to create an identity, entity, which is legitimate review versus the speech itself. The sole speech here is money. Now, the Supreme Court has said money speech. But you don't have to look at the subjective intent to see whether that money is for express or issue advocacy. It's clearly express advocacy. It went to vote yes for life and was expended to support the adoption of referred Measure 6. You don't need to go behind anything for that. So from the speech aspect, and that's solely what the Supreme Court did in the Wisconsin Right to Life case, was look at speech. And then the court in Buckley versus Vallejo says when you're looking at identities, they go, what is the purpose of the entity? Well, in this case, there's no doubt of what the purpose was. The purpose was to be involved in express advocacy, which means the state can legitimately regulate it. So confusing the two, that's what Mr. Sanford's attempting to do, is confuse the two issues to become a muddled mess. So then he wins. When you look at the provisions, when you look at the law and you look at the cases, the conduct that we have here clearly falls within the statute. You have cooperative activity of two or more people. You have change of identity of assets, which means is they collected it. And they dispersed it solely for the purpose of supporting the adoption of a ballot question. The statutes are met. To have these hypotheticals on it just doesn't, that's a witch hunt. Plain, ordinary meaning of the statute. It's not vague, and it's not overbroad in that manner. You go, did the identity of the assets change? And we're not here dealing with the analogy of a mailman. Where you're not doing anything, nor is discussions cooperative activity for the purpose of raising, collecting, or dispersing money. The fact that I would discuss a ballot measure and say, these are important things, that doesn't mean all of a sudden we're in cooperative action. We may totally disagree on it. And our discussion may mean that we're both contributing money to a ballot question committee to support different sides of it. So when you look at the statutes, look at the facts, Your Honors. And when you do that, you have to come to the conclusion that the statutes have been complied with, and the plain, ordinary, the meaning of, each of the words, collecting, raising, dispersing, are all satisfied here. And utilizing the terms contribution and expenditures doesn't need to be discussed, because that is what the committees get, and committees make contributions to another committee. So that's why the legislature used words different than the statutes, so that we didn't get convoluted in the statute's application on it. I think the legislature was wise in that purpose. It was using simple words. It was also simple words so that anybody that's looking at, are they going to form a ballot question committee, would know what it was.
2 minutes.
So, the statutes aren't vague. A reasonable person would know is that if they're cooperating for this purpose, they would fit within it. And to say that in a corporation or a marriage on it that don't fit the definition, that the secretary hasn't enforced it, well, the secretary doesn't in those situations. There's no changing of asset control. Independent activity can do it. And you have, in an established situation, unity of conduct. But when you have a shell, and when you have something that was created 45 days before the election, you can look at what is its purpose and what is it doing, and the court can say, we're not going to find unity of conduct in that situation where the cooperative activity includes the creation of the entity itself, and the sole purpose of that entity was to perform personal conduct. There's no business activity here. It is personal conduct by that unnamed third party. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hallam. Court will be in recess for 10 minutes.
Shadow. Oh. You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com. You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.
The second case for oral argument this morning is State of South Dakota versus Marcus J. Soon. Mr. Soon is the appellant. He's represented by Mr. Robert Feit, an attorney from Brookings, and the State of South Dakota is represented by Ms. Ann Meyer, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Once again, the court would like to welcome students from Esteline High School and Villa Duell High School and South Dakota State University. Mr. Feit, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, Justices of the Supreme Court, Counsel. I appreciate being given the opportunity this morning to present oral argument on behalf of my client, Marcus Soon, in a case which involves a fundamental and cherished constitutional right which all citizens of our country enjoy. That is being the right to freely express our opinions and ideas. The First and 14th Amendments to our United States Constitution guarantees all citizens of this state that right. That right also includes the right to criticize our government, our government's agencies, without fear of, or threat of criminal prosecution. To quote from the words written by Chief Justice Gilbertson in this court's decision in South Dakota versus Martin, "As freedom of expression facilitates the free-flowing exchange of ideas and debate, which occupy the very heart of our democracy, any government regulation on the content of speech is subjected to the strictest of judicial review. It is our contention that the trial court's construction and application of subsection 2 of South Dakota's disorderly conduct statute gave it an unconstitutionally broad reach which deprived Marcus Soon of his First Amendment rights. The facts of this case are straightforward, not disputed, having been presented entirely through the direct examination of Brookings Patrol Officer David Gibson. At 2:02 a.m. on September 2, 2007, which would have been an early Sunday morning, Officer Gibson was riding as a passenger in a patrol car, which was traveling down Main Street of Brookings. As the bars had just closed, the sidewalks had filled with bar patrons, and Officer Gibson testified that a crowd of 100 people were standing out on the sidewalk. He further testified that his passenger side window was down and that he heard someone yell profanities and that he identified Soon as that person. Officer Gibson testified that he heard Soon say 16 words, which for purposes of today's argument, unless the court feels otherwise, I'll summarize as a critical profanity-laced commentary towards cops.
Do you concede that your client was aiming the comments at the officer?
No. I think that Mr. Soon made a general commentary towards law enforcement. At that particular time, there had been no contact between the law enforcement officer, any particular law enforcement officer. I think the intended target was law enforcement in general.
But was it at the patrol vehicle? I understood the comment to be directed at the officers in the vehicle as they were driving by.
There was no testimony to that fact. The only testimony was that I think the traveling of the patrol car down Main Street precipitated the contact by Mr. Soon.
Well, Mr. Soon was, there was eye contact, but Mr. Soon was looking directly at this officer when he was making these comments.
The officer testified that he made eye contact with Mr. Soon after the words were said. That is correct.
How can you take that position that they weren't directly at the officer when the second sentence that he spewed out was, "You blanking cops suck"?
Well,
I mean, that's a clearly that wasn't a commentary on the general status of police enforcement throughout the world or anything.
Well, there still was, it was not a, I don't believe it was a personal attack against this particular officer himself. I think it was an attack against.
Sounds pretty personal to me.
I think it was an attack against the profession itself.
Does it make a difference, the fact that the commentary was about policemen, as opposed to if one of us judges were driving through and they would have made the same comment and substitute judge instead?
Well, I think if the target of the critical comment was directed towards a police officer, then there's even a narrower exception to the fighting words rule than would apply to an ordinary citizen. I think the U.S. Supreme Court decisions have told us in Lewis versus City of New Orleans, we've got Texas versus Hill. All of those cases have indicated that there is a higher standard or a narrower standard to be applied towards police officers.
Do you think that's fair, that we should comment on that, that a police officer needs to have a thicker skin than maybe some people from another profession?
Well, as Justice Powell said in his concurring opinion in the Lewis decision, police officers are trained for this type of thing. They should have a thicker skin because they deal in this every day. And arguably there should be a higher standard that does apply to them.
You know, this wasn't Sunday morning with people leaving a church service. This was Saturday night, early Sunday morning with the bars emptying out. Does the context in which the comments were made, where you've got 100 people standing on the side of the sidewalk, obviously many who have probably been drinking, does that create an additional risk or danger that ordinarily you wouldn't see in everyday life that turns these comments into fighting words?
No. I think, to the contrary, it's probably just the opposite. You know, the court's reasoning was that if any one person in that crowd would have found Soon's words offensive, then that alone is enough to convict Soon under the disorderly conduct statute. That clearly is not the constitutional standard that the courts have set out.
How about those words that incited the crowd against the officer?
Well, you know, Texas versus Johnson involved a flag burning case in 1987 where the argument of the state of Texas was similar to what the trial court found in this case. In that case, Johnson had burned an American flag. Texas argued that he was liable, he was guilty under a statute which made it a crime to desecrate the flag. Desecration was defined as doing something that one or more people would find so offensive that they would violently react to. In that case, the court, Justice Brennan speaking for the majority, said that the average person would not violently react to that, even if they feel strongly about it. The court in Cohen versus California, where the defendant in that case wore a jacket with the F word, F the draft, into the municipal courthouse during business hours, the court also said in that case that even though people would find it offensive and distasteful, would not agree with it, that nonetheless the First and 14th Amendments don't allow us to prohibit that kind of language or conduct. The trial court's objection to the language used in this case was the profanity, and that's the only thing that's involved in this case is Soon's speech. This is not a case of mixed conduct and speech. This is a case that only involves speech, and that is the words that were used by Soon. You know, this court said in SJNK that mere profanity can never be the basis for a conviction under our disorderly conduct statute. And, you know, that's the precedent that was established in Cohen versus California.
But if he were trying to incite a riot, you know, the court recognizes an exception for that. If you're using profanity and other epithets to incite a riot or to incite people to violence, the law clearly prohibits that. But as I understand it, in this case, there was no evidence that the crowd was incited by this, your client. In fact, the crowd, as I understand it, was disenchanted with your client, surprised at what he was doing. Is that the facts?
Well, the testimony of Officer Gibson at most was that people in the crowd took note of Soon's statement.
They said that they looked at him like, what are you doing?
Like, what are you doing? Now that.
But is the test whether or not he did incite him to riot, or whether or not it was likely to?
Well, the trial court, there were no findings by the trial. There was no testimony by the state that anybody was inconvenienced, annoyed, or alarmed by Soon's statement. There was no testimony from the police officer to that effect. There was no testimony that anybody in the crowd was inconvenienced, annoyed.
But what is the test, in your view?
That, as Houston versus Hill stated, that the words spoken have to be shown likely to produce a clear and present danger of a substantive evil that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or unrest.
So you don't need an actual riot, it just needs to be likely to cause one.
Well, clear and present danger that rises far above public inconvenience, annoyance, or arrest, yeah. Now, but the trial courts...
Which is an objective standard for a court to make, not an officer standing on the sidewalk seeing whether a riot plays out or not before he decides to make an arrest.
Well, yeah, the trial court never found Soon guilty for any reaction that was actually carried out by either the officer or the crowd. What the trial court said was that Soon's statements created a risk of someone being offended to those comments. And the trial court found that the utterances created a risk of inconvenience, annoyance, or alarm to any other person in the crowd, and that risk was based upon any one person's sensitivity to the utterance made by Soon. But the court went on further and said that because of the size of the crowd, the fact that there were 100 people out there, that a real risk existed that at least one person would have been offended by that comment, and that given the size of the crowd, a real risk existed that at least one person could have been offended by Soon's lack of tact or the disrespect that he showed to law enforcement or this officer in general. And certainly the constitutional bar that the trial court set out in construing the statute fell far below the precedents that have been firmly established in the area of First Amendment rights. The court has over and over again, in Gooding versus Wilson, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a Georgia statute which made it a crime to use language which was likely to cause a disturbance of the peace.
You cite those cases, and most of those cases have actually challenged the constitutionality of the statute. That's not the case here, is it?
No, we've not made a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the statute.
So is that a different test then? Can we use that same test that the courts have used in determining whether the words fall within the constitutional protections when the statute itself isn't being challenged, but whether or not it falls within disorderly conduct definition. Is there a difference, or do we need to look at that differently?
I don't believe so, Justice Meyer-Henry. As you know from the opinion in South Dakota versus Osmussen, where the court discussed at length the First Amendment overbreath doctrine, we're not making a facial challenge to the statute itself. We're making a challenge to the constitutionality of the trial court's construction as applied to Soon. And under that overbreath doctrine, it's our position that this court has to make a decision whether the trial court construed that statute in accordance with the Constitution. And that's irrespective of whether or not the court would determine whether or not Soon's words would even constitute fighting words. I think the first thing you do is you have to reach that issue of whether or not this was a constitutional construction of the statute. These exceptional rules, as set out by the court, apply because of the chilling effect that an overbroad construction of this statute would have on people that are not before the court. And certainly the trial court's construction of the statute, where if one person out of 100 were annoyed by a comment made, would have a chilling effect. That's not the legal standard.
Right, well, the standard's fighting words, not whether you're annoyed. I mean, people are annoyed all the time by what people say.
Well, unfortunately, though, the trial court in this instance did not apply the fighting words standard to the construction of the statute. The trial court found that Soon's words were fighting words, but the test that the court applied, if you look, when you read the decision and the memorandum opinion of the trial court and look at the findings, is all about whether one person out of 100 would have been annoyed at either the choice of the words used or the disrespect or lack of tact. So that certainly doesn't meet the constitutional standard.
So the appropriate standard would have been to try to determine whether the comments were likely to incite a riot, not whether they were going to annoy people who were on the sidewalk, correct?
Well, it certainly would have had to been construed in accordance with the fighting words standard. And you know, the U.S. Supreme Court decisions, in their review of speech-only statutes, where a state is attempting to make it a crime to say something without respect to conduct, have looked with disfavor on all of those statutes. If you know the Houston versus Hill court firmly said that these statutes are unconstitutional if you just simply say that it amounts to a breach of peace or likely to incite a riot. There has to be a much higher standard than that. I believe in order to construe the subsection 2 of the disorderly conduct statute, you're looking at subsection 1, where you're talking about the engaging in violent, threatening behavior. If you apply the Szaplinski fighting words exception to subsection 2, you end up with subsection 1. And this court, in the SJNK case, went through in some detail and discussed that. But in this particular case, there was no face-to-face confrontation between Soon and the officer. In fact, as the officer testified, Soon ignored him. He after saying these words, when the officer confronted Soon had his back to him, and because of the fact that Soon was ignoring him, he grabbed him and handcuffed him and arrested him. There was no other conduct other than the words spoken by Soon. So unlike the situation in SJNK, this did not involve a case of mixed conduct and facts. It only involved a case of speech.
He was arrested not because he made loud noises, it's because of the noises, the words that were in those noises. Is that what you're saying? The court didn't say it was an unreasonably high noise or a loud noise. It was the words that were in the noise that he was convicted of. Is that right?
That's an That's correct.
So if he had been shouting, "Praise the Lord," or "We love police officers," at the same tone of voice, not likely he would have been arrested, not likely he would have been convicted?
Well, the court never made any finding on unreasonable noise, and it was never, you know, it's apparent from the findings of the trial court and the conclusions that the trial court based everything on the content of the speech. This was not a content-neutral application of the disorderly conduct statute.
He was only charged, though. I mean, the charge against him was making unreasonable noise. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay.
And that was an apparent realization by the state that this case only involved speech by Soon. It did not involve any of the elements set out in subsection 1 of the disorderly conduct, which make reference to the fighting or violent or threatening behavior.
But you're not challenging the conviction on that ground. You're not challenging it on any ground other than the words. I mean, you're not saying it doesn't fit the statute.
Well, we are challenging that, Justice Center. Our challenge is twofold. We're challenging the fact that there was a constitutionally overbroad construction of the statute, and secondly, that the words that used by Soon did not constitute fighting words and did constitute protected speech. The sufficiency of the evidence, if you look at the trial court's test, certainly there's a possibility somebody would have been offended by those words, but the sufficiency of the evidence, if you apply a proper constitutional standard, certainly would fall far short of being what was required.
So if I understand what you're saying is that there is no circumstances where if you just utter those 16 words with no physical follow-through that they could ever violate the statute. They are protected no matter where and when you say them.
Well, I think the only way that you could ever violate that statute, if you put in a constitutional interpretation and construction on it, would be to have conduct that approaches what's in subsection 1. And that would certainly require, under the Shaplinsky rule, that you have some sort of threatening or fighting words. So you're really moving up to subsection 1. I don't think you can. By the time you construe subsection 2, you really have subsection 1.
Maybe I wasn't clear in my question. Is what you're saying is no matter where the circumstances, these 16 words are uttered, if there is no other physical follow-through, these could never be fighting words?
That is correct.
Okay. And your time has expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Veit. Ms. Meyer, you have 20 minutes.
Yeah, please, the court. A lot of the state's argument has been covered, but the point that Justice Gilbertson made about this being the whole context and the whole circumstances is what Judge Foley was looking at. If you look at his conclusions of law, and I'm talking about conclusion of law 9, the court says that what is important is the effect on the public, including the police officer. Our statute is talking about annoyance and alarm and creating that risk and inconvenience. The crowd is the key factor here. We have 100 people coming out of the bars in Brookings who presumably have been drinking. The risk is there of trouble. Because the officer intervenes, we don't automatically jump to subsection 1 of our disorderly conduct statute. If that were the case, the defense could have objected on the sufficiency of the complaint before trial, and that would be the issue, whether we charged this defendant out on the correct subsection of the statute. That's long waived, and that shouldn't be the argument here today. And again, what's important is that Sun made a disruptive noise. These people who heard this noise were not blank slates. They looked at him like, "What are you doing?" Nobody wants to hear somebody disturbing their peace with profanity at 2 in the morning. That is prohibited as an unreasonable noise under our disorderly conduct statute. And the trial court, that's what the trial court was looking at. He also made a specific reference to SJNK. He said the words that the defendant uttered are strikingly similar to what you see in those cases. There are still cases cited in that opinion that said you don't need violence, like Shuler v. State. To be fair, some of the more recent cases do look at conduct and the words said. But our statute says creates the risk. And that's what this officer was looking at, and that's why he cited or arrested or found probable cause for the violation of our disorderly conduct statute. Jumping to the first subpart of that statute, the time's passed for that. Justice Meyer Henry is also right. There is not a constitutional challenge to the statute per se. There was no notice to the Attorney General's office in this case. So we're looking at the words of the statutes and the statute and the element of the crimes, and our position is that we've met that.
So, as my understanding then, what the challenge is that the words are protected constitutionally. Therefore, if they're protected, there can't be evidence then to support disturbing noise or the unreasonable noise portion of it. So that then there's insufficient evidence if you can't use those words against him. Is that kind of the theory?
Well, we made an argument in the alternative in our brief that if you just look at the elements of the statute, whether the trial court looked at content under a right for the wrong reason analysis or just the elements of the statute, when you're looking at unreasonable noise, that we can get there as far as a crime even without the content of the words that he said.
So just the fact that he, I didn't realize that that's what you were arguing.
In that last paragraph.
That wasn't argued to the trial court, was it?
No, we're using a right for the wrong reason analysis because by the time I get the case and do the research, that, you know, I've noticed that in Indiana and Oregon. So, you know,
is there any evidence, though, in the record about the decibel level of this noise or anything else that would normally, when you think about unreasonable noise, you're thinking of a loud music or whatever
right. Coming
out of something or a machine next door that's too loud and you can't sleep. But there was no evidence of that, though, in this case, was there?
We don't have a decibel reader. That's correct. And that's a good observation. But it's, you know, for this, again, the context and the circumstances. At 2 in the morning, he's just letting fly with, you know, his profanity towards police officers and the public, and everybody's caught up in that. And that is an unreasonable noise, as our statutes are drafted by our legislature at this point in time.
Would you concede, then, if he had seen Officer Gibson on the sidewalk and walked up and there was just the two of them and looked him in the eye and said these 16 words, that they are probably protected?
Different situation. Eye-to-eye, face-to-face conduct in an interview room, something like that. Yes. Officers, however, as the defense noted, and the court talked about this, the argument Justice Powell made was that the officer is trained to not, you know, start to be belligerent back. So that is a narrower situation. And we don't have that one-on-one here.
And it isn't like they haven't heard this word before.
No, I think that some of the cases are really interesting because they say standards of decorum have changed. They change generation to generation. They change more quickly than that. When I'm reading the cases, it seems to me that it's changed just since the 90s. And we're in this flux of our language is not highfalutin, if you want to look at it that way.
Those particular words in my era would have gotten your mouth washed out with soap. Now you hear them on television.
Yes, or music, rap music, anything like that. And that would have been my generation, too. But it's just how society has evolved. And the reason for that is that the commentators say that, or in the cases say, that we're a strong enough society to absorb that kind of profanity or that kind of off-color remark in the interest of protecting our freedom and ability to speak our minds. This is America. We get to speak our minds, things like that. So are there any further questions?
Yeah, I have one. I've been to athletic events, and they start these chants back and forth. They're heckling, and sometimes they get about down as base as this is. Are we going to start, if we uphold this, are we going to start hauling people out of the stands at football games and arresting them for chants that border on this as constituting fighting words?
Depending on the context and the circumstances and how disruptive it might be, as a general chant or a cheer, you know, that probably sounds absurd for a police officer to do that. If somebody's really, really obnoxious and everyone is offended, annoyed, there's a tremendous outburst of certainly people who are reacting, saying you better shut up or I'm going to take you out, that kind of thing, yeah, that could cause a problem.
But truly, the test is not whether people are annoyed, is it? I mean, doesn't it have to be an objective as opposed to a subjective test?
It is an objective test, but to be fair, there are more recent cases that do say that you need some kind of conduct with the profanity or the invective that you're using. Our statute, however, says that you're creating a risk of public annoyance, alarm, or inconvenience. So to a certain degree, you know, we're bound by what our law says. And we have to look
unless
at those elements and apply the facts to that.
Unless it's unconstitutional.
Unless it's unconstitutional, which I might add is waived in this case. So does anyone else have any further questions? Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. The explanation to the audience, the attorney is not required to use the full 20 minutes when they complete their argument. They're entitled to sit down.
We don't hold that against them.
No. Mr. Feit, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. Just to address the time, place, and manner argument that was raised by the state, that Judge Foley was right for the wrong reasons, that's an apparent concession to our argument that Soon's words did not constitute fighting words. But that was never argued before the trial court. Was never raised by the state. And this is similar to the argument made by the state in the recent decision of State versus Morris, where it was held that this court will not consider an additional theory of guilt for the first time on appeal. And that's essentially what the state is arguing. But irrespective of that, there were no findings, absolutely none, by the trial court that this was a case that involved unreasonable noise. Nothing to indicate that anybody was even disturbed by the words used by Soon.
You know, Do you think the state of the law now is that if it's just the content of the words as opposed to adding on additional conduct, that it doesn't meet the constitutional test? That words alone can't? Do you think that the law has moved to that point?
That's absolutely what I believe. I believe speech alone, without getting to the conduct that would rise to the level of fighting words, violence, or threatening behavior, can never be constitutionally criminalized. You know, the test for a content-based application versus a content-neutral application is to look at, you need to look at the content of the speech in order to determine whether or not the speaker violated the statute. And if you have to look at the content, then the statute's content-based. In this particular case, it was, without question, the content of Soon's words that got the attention of the officer and got the attention of the trial court in its findings. I hypothesized in my brief what the reaction of the officer would have been if under the exact same circumstances he had shouted, "Brookings police are the best, keep up the good work, thank you for all your service." Or for that matter, instead of referring to cops, if he had referred to attorneys. The point is, the reaction would have been completely different. And clearly the conviction rests upon a content-based application of the statute. This court, I think, made a good analysis of the Shiplinski fighting words in its SJNK case. The trial court relied heavily on that for its position that Mr. Soon was guilty under the statute, and I think that reliance was misplaced. This court was clear in its SJNK case that you need more than just mere speech. You need a case of mixed conduct and speech.
So what was the distinction, then, you think, between that case and this one?
The fact that this is a speech-only case, Justice.
But what did the juvenile do in the SJN case?
Well, I appreciate your concurring opinion in that, where you made the distinction between a content or between a mixed case of conduct and versus a sole case of speech. But in that case, the juvenile had pursued the intended target. They'd pursued him in a vehicle. There was a continuing course of conduct that had gone on for some time. You have the obscene gesture that was made. But that involved a face-to-face confrontation, basically, between the juvenile and the intended target of that conduct. In this case, we have none of that. There is no face-to-face confrontation. There was no continuing course of conduct by Mr. Soon. In fact, as I indicated before, Soon didn't confront the officer. The officer confronted him, and the officer said that Soon ignored him. So there was absolutely no conduct beyond Soon's words in this particular case. And that absolutely distinguishes it from the SJNK case. It absolutely distinguishes it from all of the cases cited by the state for the proposition that a profanity directed towards a police officer can support a conviction for disorderly conduct. In my reply brief, I analyzed at length the factual situation in those cases. Every one of those cases involved some sort of face-to-face confrontation, and it involved some sort of continuing course of conduct and or some sort of context that put it in a threatening manner. And all of those distinctions that were present in those cases are not present in this case. Therefore, I don't believe there is, getting back to your question, Justice Meyer Henry, I don't believe there's any way that Soon can be convicted for speech only. But our challenge is twofold. We're saying that the court unconstitutionally applied the statute, and we're saying also that Soon's words were protected speech. And I think they deserve separate consideration. I don't think we've waived anything as far as challenging the construction of the statute. I think this court has to look at the trial court's construction of it, and if the statute was unconstitutionally construed, then it is unenforceable against Soon. We don't have to challenge the statute in order to preserve that under the First Amendment overbreath argument. The cases that we're relying on were all precipitated by a period of unrest in the 70s brought on by racial tension, an unpopular war. But those are the legal principles that were established that make our democracy what it is today. Soon's words weren't nice. They probably upset the officer. That's why he was arrested. But nonetheless, he had that right to say those critical statements. As Justice Brennan noted in Texas versus Hill, our right to criticize the police is what separates a democracy from a police state. Also, many of us were taught by our mothers growing up the saying that sticks and stones may break our bones, but words will never hurt us. So too in this case. I urge you to reverse the conviction of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fite. The court will take a recess, and I would point out that because we are also on the Internet and run on the hour, the next case will commence at 11 o'clock rather than the normal 10-minute break. So we are going to be in recess till 11 o'clock. I would remind you again in the audience, if you feel free to do so, there are publications available in the lobby, but they're all free. And I think they are informative as to how we do our job in resolving legal disputes in a proper manner. We'll be in recess until 11 o'clock.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.
He has used his faithful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
About losing someone that you love. Step outside with me and look for a star as we play Dust to Stardust.
You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com. You're listening to oral arguments of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The court is in recess and will resume shortly. For more information about the court, please log on to www.sdjudicial.com.
The third case for oral argument this morning is Samina Gull, M.D., appellant versus the Center for Family Medicine, and Dr. Earl Kemp, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Sean Nichols, an attorney from Sioux Falls, and for the appellees, we have Mr. Stephen Morgans and Ms. Dana Van Beek Palmer, attorneys from Sioux Falls. I understand Mr. Morgans will be presenting the argument this morning. Very well. The court should further note that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable David Gienapp, presiding judge of the Third Circuit here in Brookings, to sit in his place. With that, Mr. Nichols, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the Supreme Court, counsel. May it please the court, again for the record, my name is Sean Nichols. I represent Dr. Samina Gull and her claim against Center for Family Medicine. Before I begin, I wanted to just thank the members of the audience for also being here. Not too long ago, myself, I had the opportunity to sit through my civics class, and that's how I gathered the interest to become a lawyer, and so whether they're compelled to be here or not, they're better off for it. The facts of this case is postured before the court on a grant of summary judgment by the trial court in favor of the defense and appellees. I believe the claims are breach of contract and due process. I believe the court erred as a matter of law in granting summary judgment and asked the court to reverse. The facts that set this case up for decision began in 2004. Dr. Samina Gall was seeking a residency program and through a match process ended up being selected to complete her residency training at the Center for Family Medicine in Sioux Falls. The Center for Family Medicine is a nonprofit organization that receives public funding in order to operate, and I believe the record, the appellee's brief, is clear on that point. In the process of the residency program, Dr. Gall signed a contract. The residency is 3 years in family medicine, but a contract is executed each year with the expectation that each resident will complete the three-year program. Dr. Gall's contract began in June of 2004 and was to continue until the end of June of 2005, where, again, the expectation would be that she would sign a contract for an additional year and then an additional year until she was licensed to practice family medicine.
Did this contract promise her any employment with the center beyond her residency?
No, absolutely not. But I do think the contract, and that was my next point, is the basis for the issues before the court. The contract itself makes very clear that the resident manual applies as well to the terms of the expectations for both the residents and for the program itself. The contract says that the resident manual defines the duties and privileges of the resident as well as the governing rules, regulations, policies, and procedures of his or her employment with CFM.
Now, you aren't saying that she has a contractual right for 3 years,
no.
Or are you? Okay.
No, not at all. Our argument, and kind of just to cut to the chase, is that the resident manual says very plainly that she's entitled to notice of a proposed dismissal and an opportunity to be heard.
She did get a notice, though.
What's that?
You're not disputing that she did, in fact, get a notice of dismissal.
What I dispute is that she was terminated before her first-year contract was up. And I think that's the way to look at it. The trial court didn't look at it that way. He said, basically, that what the decision in April of 2005 by Center Family Medicine was not to renew her second-year contract. It was more than that. They terminated her employment.
So what do you contend, then, is the genuine issue of material fact here?
Well, we believe that she was fired without an opportunity to be heard, as the resident manual provides. I think it says very clearly that she is to be provided notice before the dismissal is made and an opportunity to present herself. What happened here is they said, we're giving you notice that in writing that we're not going to renew your second-year contract, but in addition to that, I think the facts show, and again, we're here on the summary judgment standard where all inferences from the facts are in favor of the non-moving party, must be construed in favor of the non-moving party. And I think from the facts there's a fair inference that this was more than just saying, hey, we're not going to renew your contract for a second year, but instead saying you're done today.
Okay, what had happened if they had said, well, we're not going to renew your contract, you will be paid through the end of the year, but we don't want you to come back?
I think that would have been appropriate, but the important thing to understand here is because they terminated her without completion of a first year, and I think if you look at the records in particular, there is a letter from Mercy Medical Center of Merced, and Dr. Gall sought employment with other institutions. That document indicates very clearly that Dr. Gall, thank you for applying to our program, but based on what happened with Center for Family Medicine, it appears to us that maybe you'd be more suited for another program. And I think from that it shows that this decision to terminate her before she had a chance to finish the first year really set the ball rolling and put her in a position where she became unemployable within the residency program. Additional thing to consider as part of this is the April 27 letter, which Center for Family Medicine contends is when they gave notice that they were not going to renew her contract, also says very clearly that we will discuss going forward in June the opportunity for you to perhaps do some type of remedial program to complete your first year. And again, completion of the first year is absolutely critical here, because now what she has is at least something to show for her efforts at the Center for Family Medicine, as opposed to when they just said, turn in your badge, your pager, your keys, you're done. She had nothing to show except that she's been in the program for 10 months and didn't get any credit for it. And didn't complete it,
but
too.
After the April 27th letter, she went before the ROC and then the CFM Board of Directors, right?
That is true.
And if they would have reversed, she'd have had her job, right?
Well, that's true. But I think, again, the distinction that is absolutely critical here is we're not talking about a decision. And what was in front of the ROC was merely a question of whether she could get the opportunity to go forward to a second year, an opportunity for a second year contract. And again, this happened after the April 27 letter and the conversation with Dr. Kemp, where he said maybe you'd be better off going somewhere else. And within a week, she was told to turn in her badge and her pager and then taken off for rotation. So I think there's a big distinction to be made, because she has a property right and a property interest in a first year contract. That's what we're talking about here. The decision to terminate that first-year contract, which was not subject to any ROC review at all. The question before the ROC was the second-year contract. I think that gets us both under a due process claim and a contract claim in a separate set of facts, a different set of facts than what the trial court really looked at when deciding to grant summary judgment in favor of the defendants.
So what is the remedy here?
Well,
that you're seeking?
The remedy is under common and statutory law, damages. And that's a question of fact. As we cite in our brief, and under the statute 21-2-1, and then Marriott versus First National Bank of Eden, this court has said that damages is a question of fact. And I believe that this case should be remanded to the jury, to have a jury decide what the amount of the damages are. Now, the trial court, as you note from the trial court's letter decision, indicates in the very last paragraph that she's entitled to payment for whatever was left, the balance of what was owed under the first-year contract. I believe there's consequential damages to her that exceed just what she was expected to be paid under that contract, because she did become unemployable after this decision was made, and after it was made without first giving her a notice and an opportunity to defend herself. And again, I think if you go back and you look at the record, particularly that April 27 letter, of Dr. Kemp, it indicates that, to the contrary of what actually happened, that this isn't the end. There's still a chance for her to do some remedial coursework for the rest of the first-year contract, and perhaps in June we'll revisit this and she'll have an opportunity to complete her first-year contract. Again, that is, as I understand it, in the medical residency program, absolutely essential. Without that, again, she's left trying to get a job, get into a residency program without or having to explain why she's got nothing to show for her first year.
She did have an opportunity, obviously, in these subsequent hearings to present her case. And what you're asking is a very technical reading of that policy handbook, in that she should have received a hearing prior to being dismissed. Is that, am I understanding your argument?
That's absolutely right.
So you don't think that the hearings afterwards were sufficient to meet a due process standard?
Here's a couple of important points to remember about that. First of all, Dr. Kemp, the one who made this decision in writing and then to the contrary suggested that maybe you should quit now, was the one that was chairing all these hearings. Second of all, as the United States Supreme Court held in Armstrong versus Manzo, and I think the breach of contract and due process claims essentially come out of the same nucleus of facts here. But they make very clear, if you are provided or are supposed to have due process, the United States Supreme Court says, the fact that it was technically done incorrectly doesn't matter. The judiciary can't step in and craft some kind of remedy. We got to go back. I mean, they did it wrong, and that's the only thing that this court, I believe, under the law, needs to ask in this case.
So you don't want specific performance. You don't want the second and third year. You want damages.
Well, I think that specific performance, well, I move for summary judgment as well. We move for summary judgment on the basis that we think that the contract is very clear. and under the Butterfield case, which this court said that the employee handbook becomes part of the contract, that they didn't follow their contract. And I think that we are entitled to judgment of the matter of law on the contract question. And the only issue really to be decided in this case is what the damages are. And I think even the trial court, although incorrectly reaching the result, acknowledges that something wasn't quite right at the way that the process was handled here. And again, I think if you just, I know it's kind of a bulky paragraph, but the paragraph, I guess if you look at it this way, if Center for Family Medicine is simply able to say, we are not going to renew your contract going forward, and you can have a hearing after that, and we can talk about it, but we've already made up our mind, we're not going to change it anyway. What is the purpose of having this contractual due process? It doesn't make sense. And again, it says when a resident is being considered for dismissal. Here, I would argue the facts show, and again, under the standard, viewing it in favor of my client, that she was dismissed before there was any type of hearing. And if you read the entire paragraph, it makes clear that the hearing is to occur within 7 days, that the hearing will be in front of
Does it change the facts at all that she did receive in December a notice of unsatisfactory performance? This is 5 months before she got this notice of non-renewal. Does that change it at all?
I do not believe so. Again, that notice doesn't say you're being considered for dismissal. This is something that's more in the nature of an academic observation. I think if you read the cases discussing the due process side of this claim, there's a compelling distinction to be made between the academic side of a resident as opposed to the employment side. It's an interesting issue, but medical residents really are a hybrid. On one set, they're there for training purposes, and there is an academic component to what they do, but the contract that I referred to, and it's page 89 in the record, says that my client is being paid $41,000 a year for her work. So there's clearly a component that exceeds any type of academic instruction in this case, and I think that when you look at that and study, okay, what are we here challenging? It's not the academic side. What we're claiming here is that we had a property interest that arose in contract, that she would be notified before being terminated, and the contract wasn't followed. And
so your complaint is that she was in fact fired when she got this notice of non-renewal, which if it had been followed according to the contract, she would have stayed on for another month or so. Were there any facts in the record to indicate that there was an exigent circumstance, that she maybe presented a danger to the patients that would indicate that they had to let her go before her contract expired?
Certainly not before this court and arguably what was before the trial court.
Okay. Were there any – was there? I haven't read the entire contract. I certainly will, but I'd like to know if you have – you can give me a provision in the contract where – there is a clause that says if the doctor presents a danger or if there's some other kind of misconduct, there can be an immediate termination. Is there anything like that in there?
Not that I saw in this contract. Certainly as a policy consideration, that just makes good sense in the practice of medicine. But again, we don't have anything in the record here that would indicate that Dr. Gall is an immediate danger to any of the patients.
I think the third paragraph of the contract says that CFM retains the right to terminate this contract at any time should the resident, in the opinion of CFM, fail to act within his or her best professional capacity.
I understand that provision, and I think that's a little bit different than what Justice Kornkamp raised as far as some immediate danger to the patient. But again, under the Butterfield case, they can bargain away their at-will employment here by indicating through an employee handbook that there's a different set of due process that's required here. And so I don't think that paragraph, which Justice Giemanfer...
Was that paragraph invoked in this case, do you know, that the termination at any time paragraph?
No, not that I've seen at all. In
the
fact,
notice of non-renewal suggests that there's going to be a completion in the first year.
In fact, if you look at the letters that Dr. Kemp authored to the RLC saying, hey, here's what we're considering, he makes explicit reference to the fact that this is in following our due process. I think it's 119 in the record. He refers to it as our due process protocol within the employee handbook.
If the termination contract had been, termination provision had been invoked, were there also due process hearing rights in connection with that, too?
Well, dismissal and termination, in my view, are essentially the same thing.
Right, but I mean, so the due process goes with the notice of non-renewal. Does the due process right to appeal the decision of for termination also come with the rights to hearings?
I would think a fair reading of the employee handbook, if there's due process for a non-renewal, that would certainly include termination. I think there's no other way to read the contract, frankly.
So then if they did, in fact, terminate her, if they did, in fact, terminate her, as you're arguing that they did, and she got the due process hearings, where is the wrong then?
Again, the termination here occurred 5 to 6 weeks before the hearing. And according to the contract, they're supposed to give her that hearing before the termination. For someone who speaks English as a second language, did not have a lawyer present with her on April 27 when the decision was made, that makes all the difference in the world. To have a lawyer present to advocate her position when the heavy hand is dropped. And I think that...
But she still got paid for May. You say terminated, but she was getting salary but not working, right?
It's kind of an interesting question, but it is part of the record. I think page 119, there's a letter that Dr. Kemp authored to South Dakota Department of Labor saying Dr. Gall quit on April 27 of 2005. It was a kind gesture to her. We paid her another month. Didn't pay her all the contract, but gave her another month to help her out, apparently, out of goodwill. But I think, again, looking at that from a question of what is she owed under the contract.
2 minutes.
If we give her the remaining $4,000 or whatever it is for the last 4 weeks of her contract, then everything's fine here. I don't think you can logically get to that point again, because what this court has said and what we've said under statute is that you're entitled to all damages that are a consequence of the other party's breach of contract. And the damages here, because she has been unemployable for a number of years, are much more than simply the $4,000 she lost out at on this contract. Again, if they had followed their contract and given her an opportunity to have an attorney present and advocate for her position before making this decision, instead of putting themselves in a situation where we're not going to change our mind for any reason at all, it would have made all the difference in the world to her going forward. And potentially could have led to either a remediational year in the program, maybe even an opportunity for a second year in the program. But certainly, I think that a jury could construe the facts as one where she would be employed today and immediately after this decision was made in 2005. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Mr. Morgans, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the court, counsel. Again, my name is Steve Morgans. With Dana Van Beek Palmer, we represent Center for Family Medicine and Dr. Earl Kemp. As a result of we're here before you after the summary judgment was granted on three causes of action that was pursued by Dr. Gould as a result of the departure from the residency program. She has not pursued an appeal of defamation action, but obviously we're here on the breach of contract appeal as well as the due process appeal.
You spend a lot of time talking about the status as an employee versus a student. Do we even need to go there?
Your Honor, I don't believe you really have to get there because even under the higher standard, even if she was considered an employee, and we think the cases say differently, but even under the status of an employee, when you look at what the due process that's required throughout those cases, we feel that when you look at the notice of the deficiencies and the opportunity to respond to those deficiencies or have hearings on those deficiencies, that the record has shows that she was provided more than the due process that is required even at the higher threshold level of an employee. This case is about a resident that it is not. There is no factual dispute that it was the Center of Family Medicine's determination that she did not fit the level of standards of a first-year medical resident. This started early on in her tenure where she was provided feedback. She was provided evaluations. Eventually that led to, in December of 2004, she had a notice of unsatisfactory performance. Now, this is significant because this is actually being placed on academic probation where she has special monitoring. She has specific goals that she needs to improve upon. And she has an opportunity to sit down at that time of probation with supervisor and Dr. Kemp to talk about the areas that she needs to improve upon. In addition to the probation, after that time frame into the spring of 2005, Dr. Gould has continuing evaluations, all of which don't get to the level of where she's meeting expectations. In other words, there's numerous ones in the evaluations. They rate them on either meeting expectations, exceeds expectations, or not meeting expectations. It's generally the system. While she has several areas where she's not meeting expectations. On April 6th of 2005, she has a meeting kind of as a review of her probationary status with Dr. Kemp. And in there, you will see when you look at the actual notice of non-renewal, at that document, they quote part of what was covered at this April 6th meeting. At this April 6th meeting, there's discussions about her continued deficiencies, the fact that she's still not meeting the requirements of a first-year student, and the fact that it's likely she is not going to get to be able to complete the first year of a residency contract.
Is the document on tab B in your, is that the one you're talking about? On your brief? Notice of non-renewal of resident contract, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Your
Honor, sorry. And there's like a box in here that has comments. And that is the way the document actually looked?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's exactly what I was referencing. And if you read around that, it talks about restating what was discussed and provided at the April 6th meeting. And the point being is that this wasn't a situation where we have a medical resident that all of a sudden on April 27th of 2005 was blindsided by the fact that her contract was not going to be renewed. There was evaluations and notice all the way through that year of work of hers, and she had she should not have been surprised by that April 27th notice.
But is that the test? I mean, it sounds to me as if you're saying that that your client followed the spirit of the contract, but not the letter of the contract. She was entitled, if I understand correctly, she was entitled to a notice of non-renewal, and that only indicated that she won't be coming back for the second year. It doesn't mean that she's immediately terminated. But that sounds like what happened here is that she got the notice that she wasn't coming back next year, but at the same time, they took her badge and everything else that made her a resident.
And just so I'm clear, and I've kind of given a general introduction, but we do not believe that the contract was breached in regards to what was required when it says when a resident is being considered for dismissal that the center shall notify the resident in writing of the charges and propose dismissal. We believe that that's what we did. That's what Center for Family Medicine did for Dr. Gould. I want to speak a little bit to your question as to what happened as of April 27th, because she's provided with this document. There's discussions with Dr. Kemp about this document. And then after that, while it's Appley's position that there's no genuine issue of material fact as to that there's not any evidence that she was actually terminated, it is a little confusing what happens after that date, because if you read Dr. Kemp's testimony and Dr. Gould's testimony in the record, she has a limited portion about the timing of what happened. But it's clear that there's a mix of her being sick and being told she can take some time off and then coming back and finding people that are covering her rotations. But what you don't find is any direct evidence, because you mentioned the fact that she was told to turn in her badge. Well, and told to turn in her badge and also her keys and her dictation, etc. Well, first of all, the first reference from that comes from the findings from the Department of Labor on the Unemployment Division. And it's our position that you cannot consider those findings to support another case. In fact, that's what South Dakota statutory law determines at 61.7-24. But even more important than that, if you actually read the Department of Labor decision, it actually states that her departure from employment was actually the result of confusion or lack of communication from between the parties.
Well, you say she quit. By reading it correctly, you say Dr. Gull could have finished out the term of her first year contract, but instead chose to quit. He's saying she was fired. You're saying she quit. Why is that not a question of fact?
Well, it's our position. Dr. Kemp testified that he never terminated her, so there is a dispute as to whether he said you're terminated. What you don't have on the other side is Dr. Gould testifying that he told me I was fired. What happened was after this confusion, after these ensuing days and week, after this April 27th note, and she advised them that I don't feel well, and obviously this was a lot of stress in her life, and there's even a medical record in the record itself about her going in to be seen. But what happens is, after these confusing days, she comes in and says, in her testimony says, Dr. Kemp, what am I supposed to do? And her response is, Dr. Kemp told her this, you know, turn in your keys and so forth. There's nothing in there where there's no affidavit or testimony where she says, well, what do you mean? Am I being fired if there is any confusion? I think the record's pretty at most it was a misunderstanding that CFM thought she quit. She may have thought they're letting me go because somebody was covering my rotation. But so there is some confusion on the actual what happened after the notice of non-renewal. But you have to keep in mind that when she was given this notice of non-renewal of contract, she was notified that as of June 30th, 2005, she was not going to be coming back this next year. It was for a future time frame. And as a practical matter, the circuit court in this case, the only gap between what she would have been entitled to under that contract, because she was paid for May, that was acknowledged in oral argument and in the briefs, was the last month of her contract, and where she fought the unemployment benefits and received some. But the circuit court in this case awarded judgment to Dr. Gould that last month anyways, and for practical purposes, and it came about it at oral argument, counsel for CFM essentially said to Judge Cirska that, Your Honor, if it means that this case is resolved by acknowledging that she would be paid one more month of salary, I'm sure my clients would be happy with it. That's the circumstances surrounding why we get that ruling of allowing that last month of salary. But it's our position that there's no affirmative evidence to say that she was terminated. At most, what we have is her subjective belief that she was terminated. But even so, she was given the full extent of her contract through the award of this case, which we have not cross-appealed before this court.
Now, just for a point of, if you don't finish a residency program, you can't practice medicine. Is that right? So she would have to either complete this someplace else or take a different residency. Is that what happens then?
That's my understanding, Your Honor. And appellees acknowledge that the position where she was at that point, when from an academic standpoint, they said, we're not going to be able to essentially allow you to complete that first year. We're not going to renew you for, I mean, not, they said she's not going to be able to finish the first year on time. I want to be specific on that. And that she would not be renewed for the next year. That does put her in a bind as far as profession. And in fact, the discussions about, I don't think there's anything in the record that I've ever been aware of that Dr. Kemp specifically told her she should quit. There was some discussions about she may be better off starting over in another program. And in fact, he indicated because she was dealing with some family issues with her husband sick in California, which I think comes out in the medical record, on the certified record, he's essentially saying, you know, programs may better understand the fact that you're away from your support system, you were had difficulties being away from that, and that's why you need to start fresh, and that it's almost better than finishing up and not getting a completion of your first year approval. So, long answer to a short question, but...
But they would have allowed her to redo her first year. Is that in the evidence?
As of April 27th of 2005, they would have allowed her to do that, I believe. And that would be at certified record 89. Because they do discuss the fact of her still taking remedial courses at that point in time.
But it says in the notice that it would be in her best interest to repeat her first year of residency in another community. So they're not suggesting they do it there.
Yeah, and I think they did. I think that was their conclusion, is that because of, and I didn't go into it in detail about the circumstances of her deficiencies, but there were trust issues with other residents, with nurses, with physicians in her evaluations. They're basically saying it's a little harder to repeat a first year now when you got people already acknowledging that you need to work and improve to be a physician that we're going to allow you to treat patients. I wanted to point out specifically, and I know it's on certified record 89, but a couple of things that she was told at that April 6th meeting was, number one, she was not going to be able to successfully complete her first year. They also say that they're not even sure if she's going to be able to develop skills to apply basic clinical knowledge to see patients, even with this remedial help they're discussing. And really significant that they basically tell her at that point that progress in these areas that they cover in this April 6th meeting are going to be reassessed in June to determine whether she'll be given an opportunity to repeat a modified first year in the program. So I think it's really difficult for appellants to argue that she was not given that notice of the possibility that she was going to be non-renewed when we have all the discussions. This is after she's been on probation, after poor evaluations, that she would not realize as of April 6th that, you know what, we may not bring you back next year. And frankly, if they do adhere to their argument that by technically reading that the handbook, that she was required to have these hearings before the decision was final, then it's our position, Your Honors, that this April 6th notice, she should have invoked the procedures at that point, because she would have known at that point that, boy, I should know that I may not be able to continue on.
The fact they'd already made up their mind prior to any hearings, is that significant in determining whether or not she actually received due process?
In regards to the due process?
To not renew or to dismiss her. Does that figure in?
Your Honor, I don't believe so, in that when you look at the process that she had, the procedure that she had after that, and in fact, when you look at the actual notice, they're recommending that she's going to be, I mean, they say that they're giving her notice that she will not be non-renewed as of June. The question becomes, if they had put in a word in there saying, we're recommending non-renewal, what would have been different at those hearings that she went through at three different levels with over 30 different physicians, medical employees, people that observe residents? What would have been, what different would have been presented by Dr. Gu at that point? And again, when you look at...
Is that her burden of proof?
I'm sorry.
Is that her burden of proof to show that there'd be something different, a different outcome?
Well, I think the fundamental question is still whether she had adequate process. It's just simply a point of CFM that there's a complaint that this prevented her from having adequate process. And yet we know that had one word been changed, if they believe that there was a technical violation of the contract, which we don't agree with, she would have went through the same hearings. There was no rebuttable presumption that she was terminated. The same people would have considered. In fact, there was a dissenting vote in the Resident Oversight Committee. It was 17-1, but this was not a sham process where there's a conspiracy to get Dr. Gould out with adequate process. There was somebody that's speaking up on behalf of her. Now, it's not very good odds in her favor, but it clearly was not a sham procedure.
What about the 2 months? I mean, it seems to me that we're arguing about a lot of things here, but really it comes down to consequential damages for not finishing out the first year. Is there a dispute of fact about whether she was told to turn in her badge and keys and et cetera before the end of the contract year?
I think after that April 27th date...
2 minutes.
After that April 27th date, Justice Zinner, there was a question of whether... there was a factual dispute whether she was told that, yes. But even assuming that Dr. Kemp told her to do that, when you look at the factual record from Dr. Gould's testimony, from her presentation, and you go through what happened during those time frames, at most you just have her coming in and saying, what am I supposed to do, Dr. Kemp? And he says, under the apparent belief that she's quitting, is turn in your keys, dictation, that's what you need to do to finish. But ultimately, even if you would believe that factual confusion at that time frame is a material fact, ultimately we believe that that's overridden by the damages issue, and that she essentially has been awarded all that we believe she is entitled to if that case could have proceeded anyways.
What about consequential damages?
Under South Dakota law, appellees believe that you are restricted under the terms of the contract, that you're only allowed to claim what you would have received under the terms of the contract. And I'll give you a citation because this came up in the reply brief of appellants, but Bad Wound versus Lakota Wounds, it's 1999 SD 165. And so it's our position that South Dakota law does not allow consequential damages for the profits for the rest of your career. You can imagine the trial that would occur to try to see if, A, she would have completed the residency anyways or under some other program, and then whether she would have made it as a doctor when you have all these issues of whether she was qualified, and it would create an incredible factual difficulty in trying to try those type of damages in this case, and that's why South Dakota law limits you to what's allowed under the contract.
Your time has expired, Mr. Morgan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Nichols, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson. A couple of things that I just want to say briefly about the contract and then move on to due process. But as Justice Zinner's question anticipated, I guess, shed some light on, is there a question of fact regarding whether Dr. Gold was told to turn in a badge, the keys, a pager? And as I heard the presentation here, I believe the answer to that is no. Within 5 to 6 days of the April 27 letter, her rotations were suspended, and basically her affiliation with Center for Family Medicine was over. So that is the basis of why we've moved for summary judgment to the trial court, suggesting, hey, they breached their contract. I understand the burden on summary judgment is very high. I would ask that, first and foremost, that we be granted summary judgment on that. Well, I guess the trial court be reversed or affirmed. I'm not even sure what the trial court decided on that issue. It's part of the problem. But second to that, I believe there is, at a minimum, a question of fact as to whether or not Dr. Gall was terminated prior to the completion of her first-year contract. And getting back to Justice Konenkamp, I apologize. I probably didn't answer the question as articulate as I would have liked earlier, but the dismissal paragraph of the employee handbook says when a resident is being considered for dismissal, and it doesn't say non-renewal, it doesn't say terminated, it doesn't say fired, it doesn't use some other verbiage. The verbiage is dismissal. They drafted it, and I believe that the handbook becomes part of the contract under South Dakota law, and if there's anything ambiguous about the term dismissal, I think that the ambiguity goes against the drafter. And clearly, the fact that Dr. Gold was terminated, or at least there's a question of fact, and under the standard this court is bound to fall, that has to go back to the jury to decide, at a minimum, whether or not the decision was made.
What do you say to counsel's comment that on April 6th there was a meeting and they told her that she was not going to be able to complete the year, words to that effect?
Well, and again, if you look at the April 27 letter, though, to the contrary, suggests that the opportunity to complete some type of first-year remedial program or at least stay in the program was at her, still up for deliberation, still being considered. And in fact, that document says we'll think about it in June. Well, how do you square that with, at the same time, telling her maybe you should go somewhere else? Why don't you leave? We're going to pull your rotations and effectively embargo any further participation with our program. And I think, again, that is the April 27 letter, something they drafted. Clearly a promise in writing to the extent as to what her future involvement with CFM was. And I think that creates an additional question of fact for the jury to consider whether Dr. Gall was promised or had some expectation, some property interest in continued participation within the Center for Family Medicine. I don't think in a growth industry that's 17% a year, it's too much to ask that they follow their contract. Now, I want to speak very briefly about due process. Again, there was some...
Yeah, CFM basically had the right to assign the duties under the contract, right? They could assign her to do anything.
The rotations for all residents, whether remedial or otherwise, was something that...
But yes, they weren't committed to give her any specific rotation or even require her to show up to work.
Yes, but we have this promise again that maybe we're going to keep you around till June. And then decide whether or not you'll be able to do something going forward. And I think that we have that reduced to writing. And although this is an at-will state, this court has held on numerous times that promises that the employer offers as inducement to the employee or for continued employment can form a basis for some type of relationship beyond at-will. Now, back to the due process question, I want to be clear. There was some reference in the brief that, well, we haven't properly demonstrated that due process even applies here. Again, they moved for summary judgment on the question of due process, and it was their burden to put something in the record to suggest that due process doesn't apply, even though they acknowledge that they receive public funds. What the United States Supreme Court has said in Brentwood Academy versus Tennessee Secondary School numerous times, that even a private organization that receives some public benefit can be bound by the 14th Amendment. And the Brentwood Academy case dealt with, I believe, textbooks that were donated from the public school district to a private school. But there's a difficult test. But I think that's something that the trial court needs to decide. That's not a question before this court. I believe there is enough evidence to suggest that they receive public funding, and then it would be for the trial court to decide whether or not the test, the public funding test, to connect the dots between the 14th Amendment and a private actor applies in this case. Now, the more important issue, and I think the one that the trial court really missed the boat on, was the question of, well, isn't the standard of due process much less in an academic setting? I don't think there's any question that even a student at a public school or some type of public entity is entitled to at least some expectation of due process and has some interest, whether property or liberty, in continued education. The question is, what process is due? Of course, Cleveland versus Loudermill says that, and also Armstrong versus Manzo, that the due process must occur in a meaningful time, in a meaningful manner. In other words, it depends on the situation in which the process claim arises. Here, and unlike the cases cited by the appellee in their brief, we're not talking about a process arising out of an academic situation. Yes, they're saying, hey, we think that you weren't doing a good job, and our basis for wanting to terminate you going forward is because you aren't a good student. But the problem is the property interest that we're asserting here is a contract right, and it's bound in employment with the expectation that she would have some opportunity to defend herself before an adverse decision is made. Very different than an academic situation, and again, the Ross, I believe the case out of Minnesota, which was cited by both parties, indicates you look at the context in which the claim arises for a resident, because we are dealing with a hybrid, someone who is both an employee receiving some financial benefit for the work that they perform and also receiving some on-the-job apprenticeship training. Again, if you look at the context of which the claim arises here, it is based on her contract. And so even though there might be some question of the academic nature, we're not asking this court to trump their academic judgment. We're just simply asking that the contract be observed. And again, it's not appropriate to get into a guessing game. Well, isn't it a fact that our records show she wasn't doing a good job and she's going to be out anyway? So why go through the motions and having a jury decide what looks like to us to be a question of maybe some continued maybe 4 weeks in the program? You can't do that. That's the jury's function under both a due process or contract argument. Again, the United States Supreme Court has said, first of all, you can't unring the bell. That once the protocol, once the process hasn't been followed, you got to go back to square one and have somebody else decide.
2 minutes.
And it may very well be that that's a realm of expert testimony. But again, that is for the jury to listen, gauge the facts, and decide whether or not Dr. Gull has been damaged somewhere beyond the month or so of the continued employment. And one other thing that I just note, both under contract or due process, the standard isn't surprise. It's not, well, hey, Dr. Gull, weren't you kind of alerted based on some of these notices that we provided? One thing that I would note with that as well is, as is the case in almost every case I've ever been a part of, the answer is usually somewhere in the middle. And Dr. Gall believes that some of these notices were, there's more to the story, that she would have an opportunity to explain that it really isn't quite as it seems. That, again, is the purpose for having due process in the first place, that she has an opportunity not to just address Dr. Kemp or some other doctor that passes on this note that's compiled in some after-the-fact hearing, but have everybody sit in front of her with an attorney who speaks English as a primary language and have a chance to tell her side of the story before a very, very important decision is made that will affect her life forever. I see my time has expired. I thank you.
Thank you, counsel. This will complete our oral arguments for the first day of our term. If you wonder what happens after this, the court does study the records that were sent up from the trial court below, and ultimately we render a decision. Those decisions are public record, and they are posted as they are issued on our website, which is found at the back of the case synopsis. It's www.sdjudicial.com. And generally the media also reports when they are issued. So if you hear of one of these cases you heard argued this morning being issued, you can read the entire opinion on our webpage when it's issued. Also, reminder to help yourselves if you're so inclined on the way out the door. We do have an illustrated booklet on how the legal system works. In this case, they use the example of internet piracy, how somebody who did not intend to become a person who violated the law by facts happened to blunder into that, and how a criminal and civil case are distinguished from each other and ultimately what happens. So thank you all for coming, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.